At about 1 o'clock on the afternoon of January 5th, the British arrived at Richmond, formed a line, and launched cannon fire into the city. One shot took off the top of a butcher's house near Jefferson's Shaco Hill quarters. According to Isaac Granger Jefferson, in 10 minutes not a white man was to be seen in Richmond. They ran hard as they could to a camp of American soldiers on Bacon's Quarter Branch in northern Richmond. It was chaos. The British was dressed in red, Isaac Granger Jefferson recalled. He saw them marching. Thomas Jefferson had left the governor's residence to avoid capture, and spent the hours of the invasion circling Richmond in efforts to secure supplies and to rendezvous with American officers. He was right to leave the center of the action. The British had brought along handcuffs in expectation of arresting the author of the Declaration of Independence. Reaching the house on Shaco Hill, a British officer asked where Jefferson was. "He's gone to the mountains," said George Granger, Isaac's father, protecting the master. "Where's the keys to the house?" the officer asked in Isaac's recollection. Isaac's father handed over the keys. "Where's the silver?" the officer asked. "It was all sent up to the mountains," George Granger said. It was a lie. As Isaac recalled it, his father had put all the silver about the house in a bed tick and hid it under a bed in the kitchen, and saved it too. Benedict Arnold soon removed himself back to the coast. The British, meanwhile, seized a large number of Jefferson's slaves, including Isaac Granger Jefferson. As they were marched out of Richmond, they heard the sounds of war. One blast, Isaac Granger Jefferson recalled, was like an earthquake. Would it have made a difference to the defense of Richmond if the call for militia had gone out earlier? Writing from Richmond a month after the invasion, Jefferson himself believed that men of enterprise and firmness would have been able to capture Arnold on his march to and from this place. Presumably, then, an activated militia would have been of military value. Jefferson had plenty of strength in his soul, but on this occasion he misjudged the moment. By waiting, Jefferson had made a common political mistake. He had followed the people rather than led them. Many of the Virginians who did the actual fighting in militias were unhappy and skeptical about the elite that Jefferson embodied and represented. The culture of Virginia was not conducive to rapid military deployment in the best of times. Now, in wartime, militias were even more difficult to muster. Mild laws, a people not used to war and prompt obedience, a want of the provisions of war and means of procuring them, render our orders often ineffectual, oblige us to temporize, and when we cannot accomplish an object in one way, to attempt it in another, Jefferson told a French newcomer in March 1781, the Marquis de Lafayette, who had reached Virginia to take command of Continental troops. It may not have been fear of the British that kept Jefferson in check for those 2 days. It is possible that he feared mobilizing a public when he could not be sure the threat was real, thus risking the wrath of the people. By hesitating, he failed to bring his constituents along to the place they needed to be. The lessons Jefferson was learning, painfully, in Virginia, would help him immensely in later years, when his responsibilities were even larger. Boldness and decisiveness were sometimes virtues in a leader. Having failed to be either bold or decisive during the invasions of Virginia, he gained valuable experience about the price of waiting. At the time, however, he could not have known that one day he would owe something of his presidential success to his failures of 1781. Chapter 13. Redcoats at Monticello. Such terror and confusion you have no idea of. Governor, council, everybody scampering. Betsy Ambler, daughter of Rebecca Burwell. Jefferson's Virginia was teetering in the face of British force. Lord Cornwallis and Lieutenant Colonel Bannister Tarleton, who was noted for his ferocious tactics, turned their attention toward the state in the late spring of 1781. Fearing the conquering redcoats, Governor Jefferson and the Virginia General Assembly retreated from Richmond to Charlottesville, but even there the legislature could barely muster a quorum. In this difficult period, the Jeffersons endured a by now all too familiar tragedy, the death of yet another child. 3 of their children had now died. This one, Lucy Elizabeth, not quite 6 months old, died at about 10 o'clock on an April morning in 1781. Jefferson chose to stay with Patty the next day, declining to attend a meeting of the State Council. "The weather was bad in any event," Jefferson wrote his colleagues, "and there being nothing that I know of very pressing, and Mrs. Jefferson in a situation in which I would not wish to leave her, I shall not attend today." His day with Patty as they grieved together was a rare moment of domestic communion, for there were now few respites from the press of business. By Monday, May 28, 1781, Jefferson knew a reckoning was at hand. British troops were advancing inland, toward Charlottesville. There were riots over a draft for militiamen across Virginia. Jefferson was reduced to asking George Washington for the general's personal assistance. "As things stood," Jefferson wrote to Washington, "with an inadequate militia facing British regulars, the minds of the people could conceive of no human power to ward off the inevitable victory of British forces. Only Washington's appearance among them, I say, would restore full confidence of salvation, and would render them equal to whatever is not impossible." Jefferson wrote these words on the 28th, and he intended to stand down as governor at the expiration of his term a few days hence. As he told Washington, his long-declared resolution of relinquishing the governorship to abler hands has prepared my way for retirement to a private station. To speak of private stations and the end of one's burdens, what he called the labors of my office, in such an emergency does not put Jefferson in a flattering light. With the assembly on the run and the state in jeopardy, one wishes Jefferson had transformed himself into a heroic savior on horseback, rallying Virginians to the field to stop the British. He was not, however, a savior on horseback. The tragedy of the British invasion of Virginia in the spring of 1781 was that no patriot leader rose to the occasion to repel Arnold, Cornwallis, or Tarleton. The war was too diffuse, the circumstances too fluid to be in anyone's control, even Jefferson's, and he had devoted the previous 2 years to working on the military defense of Virginia's borders. He spent Saturday, June 2, 1781, at Monticello with his family and house guests, including the speakers of the Virginia House and Senate. The lawmakers were availing themselves of Jefferson's hospitality as they waited for the legislative session scheduled to take place in Charlottesville on Monday, June 4. Jefferson's successor was to be elected at this meeting. Jefferson's considered counsel to his colleagues in the government was that they elect Thomas Nelson, Jr., a man with political and military experience. "It was time," Jefferson said, "for a union of the civil and military power in the same hands," a move that the previous 2 years had taught him would greatly facilitate military measures. Unbeknownst to the party at Monticello, Cornwallis had ordered Tarleton to pursue the government to Charlottesville. Riding fast, the British dragoons passed the Cuckoo Tavern in Louisa on Sunday, June 3, 1781. It was late, somewhere between 9 and 10 p.m., when the British rode by. A giant of a Virginia militiaman named Jack Jewett, said to be 6'4" and 220 pounds, was in Louisa. Realizing that the enemy was en route to capture Jefferson, Jewett broke away for a daring nighttime ride of 40 miles. Mounted on a horse, said to be the best and fleetest of foot of any nag in 7 counties, Jewett crashed through the wilderness. Careering through woodlands and along ridges, Jewett avoided well-known roads in order to stay clear of the enemy. According to one account, his face was cruelly lashed by tree branches as he rode forward, and scars which are said to have remained the rest of his life were the result of lacerations sustained from these low-hanging limbs. The British broke their march at a plantation around 11 p.m. There they rested for about 3 hours, thus giving Jewett a bit of time. Tarleton stopped again deep in the night to set fire to a wagon train of supplies en route to confronting the rebel troops. Jewett arrived at Monticello just before dawn and told Jefferson of the impending strike. Coolly, Jefferson ordered breakfast served to the household, summoned a carriage for his family, and bade farewell to the legislators, who descended the mountain back to Charlottesville. Patty and the 2 children and 2 slaves set out in search of safety at a nearby plantation. At Monticello, Jefferson was largely alone. At least two slaves were still there. One was Martin Hemings, and were hiding silver in anticipation of the raid. Jefferson tried to rescue his documents. In preparing for flight, I shoved in papers where I could. He then did something in character. He decided to see things for himself. His instincts for control and for action drove him from Monticello to a neighboring peak, known both as Mont Alto and as Carter's Mountain. He took his spyglass with him. Looking out at Charlottesville, he did not note anything extraordinary. He turned to go, but realized that his sword cane had slipped to the ground. As he retrieved it, his curiosity got the better of him. He peered through his glass again. That was when he saw the British. Back at Monticello, Jefferson mounted his best horse, Caractacus, and took off after his family. The redcoats arrived 5 minutes after he left. One cocked a pistol, aimed it at Martin Hemings' chest, and demanded to be told where Jefferson was or he would fire. "Fire away, then," Hemings said. There would be no gunfire at Monticello during its brief occupation by the British, nor would there be any looting. One exception. The redcoats drank some of Jefferson's wine. Legend has it that they used it to toast George III's birthday. Cornwallis was far less circumspect about Jefferson's other plantations, especially Elk Hill, where the British burned his barns and crops and scattered his slaves. 23 of Jefferson's slaves ran away from his plantations amid the Tarleton-Cornwallis invasion. At least 15 of these died of disease in British camps at Yorktown or Portsmouth. Riding away from Monticello, Jefferson caught up with Patty and the children, and they ultimately sought refuge at Poplar Forest, the family's Bedford County estate. His family was safe, and he was safe. His reputation was not. On Tuesday, June 12, 1781, the legislature, now meeting at Trinity Church in Stanton, Virginia, expressed its gratitude to Jack Jewett with a brace of pistols and a sword, tokens to honor his brave journey through the darkness. It also passed a resolution that cut Jefferson to the core. Resolved, that at the next session of the Assembly an inquiry be made into the conduct of the executive of this state for the last 12 months. Jefferson could imagine nothing worse. His courage and his competence were both in the dock. It was bad enough that such calamities had struck while he was in office. Though he might not have admitted it, even to himself, as he played and replayed recent history in his mind, he must have known that two invasions and the chasing of the state government from Charlottesville to Stanton were debacles to be charged to his political account. Those he could probably handle. George Washington's standing had survived defeats. What he needed was time. Time to decide in tranquility how best to serve the cause in which he so believed. Instead, he was now forced into a fight over his own past. He did not bother to conceal his anger. In a tart note, Jefferson wrote that since the motion could not be intended just to stab a reputation by a general suggestion under a bare expectation that facts might be afterwards hunted up to bolster it, "I hope you will not think me improper in asking the favor of you to specify to me the unfortunate passages in my conduct which you mean to adduce against me." In the same Trinity Church session in which the lawmakers voted to investigate Jefferson, they debated a motion that implicitly suggested the fault for the chaos of the invasions lay not with the office holder, but with the office itself. It was argued that the time had come for a dictator, who should have the power of disposing of the lives and fortunes of the citizens thereof, without being subject to account. Patrick Henry spoke in favor of the dictator measure, saying that executive, whatever he was called, needed to be armed with such powers necessary to restrain the unbridled fury of a licentious enemy. The motion and the debate tend to exculpate Jefferson, suggesting as they do that those closest to the events believed the problems of authority were structural. The problem had been the governorship, not the governor. The motion failed, narrowly. Accounts of Jefferson's terrible time as governor often failed to try to reconcile the two votes. The first, the vote for an inquiry, amounted to an indictment of Jefferson's conduct. Yet the second, the vote for new powers for Jefferson's successors, amounted to a tacit admission that Jefferson had not possessed authority commensurate with the challenges of the time. To blame Jefferson for failure in an executive office while simultaneously attempting to reform that office logically shifts responsibility from the individual to the institution. Logic, however, is rarely a big part of politics. Jefferson's foes saw an opportunity to embarrass him. Though the House inquiry was short-lived, the Assembly ended up commending, not condemning, Jefferson. The episode lived on in the mind of Jefferson and in the memories of his political opponents. His bitterness at the charge that he had been derelict in his duty was palpable. There was, Jefferson said, no foundation for any official aspersion. Another opportunity for Jefferson to serve as an envoy in France came in September, a further sign that Jefferson's performance as governor, while no one's finest hour, with the possible exceptions of Jewett and of Martin Hemings, was not politically fatal. Yet Jefferson declined the diplomatic appointment. He had, he said, taken my final leave of everything of that nature, have retired to my farm, my family, and books, from which I think nothing will ever more separate me. With this disinterested assertion of bucolic retirement, though, came a determination to stay in Virginia politics long enough to clear his name. A desire to leave public office with a reputation not more blotted than it has deserved will oblige me to emerge at the next session of our Assembly, and perhaps to accept of a seat in it. But as I go with a single object, I shall withdraw when that shall be accomplished, he said in September 1781. He was to stay out of office for about a year and a half, a period in which he suffered much from the pain of the rumors about his governorship. Yet he could never totally withdraw from the world, and the world's opinion still mattered to him. In October 1781, the Americans triumphed at Yorktown, effectively ending the war. Still captive, as were several other Jefferson slaves, Isaac Granger Jefferson witnessed the battle. There was tremendous firing and smoke. Seemed like heaven and earth was come together, he recalled. He remembered hearing the cries of the wounded. When the smoke blow off, you see the dead men laying on the ground. The war was won, and to most appearances, Thomas Jefferson had triumphed, his cause vindicated and victorious. A French visitor to Monticello in 1782, the Marquis de Chateauneuf, came away dazzled by its master. Let me describe to you a man, not yet 40, tall, and with a mild and pleasing countenance, but whose mind and understanding are ample substitutes for every exterior grace. An American, who, without ever having quitted his own country, is at once a musician, skilled in drawing, a geometrician, an astronomer, a natural philosopher, legislator, and statesman. A senator of America, who sat for 2 years in that famous Congress which brought about the Revolution. A governor of Virginia, who filled this difficult station during the invasions of Arnold, of Phillips, and of Cornwallis. A philosopher, in voluntary retirement from the world and public business, because he loves the world, inasmuch only as he can flatter himself with being useful to mankind. For no object had escaped Mr. Jefferson, and it seemed as if from his youth he had placed his mind, as he has done his house, on an elevated situation, from which he might contemplate the universe. This was how Jefferson wanted to be seen. The reality, he felt, was rather different. He believed himself a failure. Even the American victory could not take Jefferson's mind completely off his controversial final hours as governor. He told James Monroe that one of the worst aspects of the legislative inquiry was the possibility that the public would believe that he stood arraigned for treasons of the heart and not mere weakness of the head. Attacks on his service, he said, had inflicted a wound on my spirit which will only be cured by the all-healing grave. He added a final note. Mrs. Jefferson has added another daughter to our family. The child was named Lucy Elizabeth, after the sister who had died not long before her own birth. Patty had no more strength. There were no reserves to draw on, no means by which to rally. She has been, ever since, Jefferson said, and still continues, very dangerously ill. Chapter 14. To Burn On Through Death. Mrs. Jefferson has at last shaken off her tormenting pains by yielding to them, and has left our friend inconsolable. Jefferson friend Edmund Randolph to James Madison. His wife was dying. The latest child, the second Lucy Elizabeth, was Patty Jefferson's sixth in 10 years. Patty was only 33, but her body was exhausted. The tensions and exertions of the war, culminating in the family's evacuation of Monticello, exacerbated the state of her health. She may have suffered from tuberculosis. By the early summer of 1782, she was confined to her bed. Her husband refused to leave her side. Day after day, week after week, month after month, Jefferson was never out of calling, his daughter Patsy recalled long afterward. He spared himself few details of his wife's care, helping her take medicines and guiding cups to her lips. Either at her bed or in a small room nearby that opened onto hers, he kept vigil. Patty, too, craved Jefferson's company. Her eyes ever rested on him, ever followed him, according to family tradition. When he spoke, no other sound could reach her ear or attract her attention. When she waked from slumber, she looked momentarily alarmed and distressed, and even appeared to be frightened if the customary form was not bending over her, the customary look upon her. Monticello and each other became their only reality. She had strength enough to begin writing some lines from Sterne, they were from Tristram Shandy, on a small piece of paper. Time wastes too fast. Every letter I trace tells me with what rapidity life follows my pen. The days and hours of it are flying over our heads like clouds of windy day, never to return. More everything presses on. She faded at this point. Jefferson finished the passage for her. And every time I kiss thy hand to bid adieu, every absence which follows it are preludes to that eternal separation which we are shortly to make. Sterne's message here is tragic, unrelentingly so, for even moments of human communion and love are seen not as fulfilling in themselves but ephemeral, a stark yet realistic vision of life. James Monroe sensed the scope of the crisis and the depth of his patron's sadness. I have been much distressed upon the subject of Mrs. Jefferson, and have feared that the report of each succeeding day would inform me she was no more. Monroe called on God for her recovery. It may please heaven to restore our amiable friend to health, and thereby to you, a friend whose loss you would always lament, and to your children, a parent which no change of circumstances would ever compensate for. The prayer was futile. It was nearly noon on Friday, September 6, 1782, when the end came. According to Monticello tradition, the house servants, including Elizabeth Hemings, were among those with Patty Jefferson as she lay dying. Edmund Bacon, who managed the plantation in later decades, said that the Monticello slaves have often told my wife that when Mrs. Jefferson died, they stood around the bed. Mr. Jefferson sat by her, and she gave him directions about a good many things that she wanted done. Like her late mother-in-law, Patty was commanding to the last. When she came to the children, she wept, and could not speak for some time. Finally, she held up her hand and told him she could not die happy if she thought her children were ever to have a stepmother brought in over them. To extract a promise of eternal faithfulness from a man like Jefferson, vital, sexually energetic, only 39, could be seen as a selfish deathbed request. Patty, however, was most likely thinking of her children and their happiness. She may have believed that the combined maternal influences of the girl's aunts, and perhaps of Elizabeth Hemings, whom Patty had known so long and so intimately, were sufficient without risking the introduction of an unknown woman as mistress of the house. Patsy was nearly 10, Polly 4, Lucy an infant. Jefferson was rich, celebrated, and charming. But he gave his promise. He would, he assured his dying wife, never marry again. Among the reported witnesses to that pledge was Sally Hemings, Patty's half-sister, who was not quite 10 years old. At 11:45 on that Friday, Patty Jefferson died. In the final moments, Jefferson's sister, Martha Carr, had to help the grieving husband from his wife's bedside. He was, his daughters recalled, in a state of insensibility when Mrs. Carr, with great difficulty, got him into the library where he fainted. And not for a brief moment. Jefferson remained so long insensible that they feared he would never revive. When he did come to, he was incoherent with grief, and perhaps surrendered to rage. There is a hint that he lost all control in the calamity of Patty's death. According to his daughter Patsy, the scene that followed I did not witness, presumably the scene unfolded in the library when he revived, but the violence of his emotion, when almost by stealth I entered his room by night, to this day I dare not describe to myself. Patsy was writing half a century later. A pallet to lie on was brought to give him some comfort in the little library, yet his grief drove him out of doors in a kind of frenzy. Patsy attached herself to her father as if clinging to the one remaining constant in her life. For her, siblings had come and gone, and now her mother was dead. Given the demands of his wartime leadership, Jefferson would have seemed a loving, if somewhat distant, figure to her. Yet he adored his family, idealizing it in many ways, and he would have seen in Patsy, with her strength and evident maturity in dealing with a father in the grip of grief, images of his mother, of his sister Jane, and, of course, of Patty. He held her close. She held him close. The pattern of warmth and intimacy between father and daughter that set in during this dark spell of despair persisted for the rest of their lives. He kept his room for 3 weeks, and I was never a moment from his side, Patsy said. He walked almost incessantly, night and day, only lying down occasionally when nature was completely exhausted, on a pallet that had been brought in during his long fainting fit. My aunts remained constantly with him for some weeks. I do not remember how many. He could not remain still. When at last he left his room, he rode out, and from that time he was incessantly on horseback, rambling about the mountain, in the least frequented roads, and just as often through the woods. In those melancholy rambles I was his constant companion, a solitary witness to many a burst of grief, the remembrance of which has consecrated particular scenes of that lost home beyond the power of time to obliterate. He drove himself as though sheer movement could alleviate his loss. In one of the first letters he wrote after the disaster of September 6, 1782, he said, "I had had some thoughts of abstracting myself a while from this state by a journey to Philadelphia, or somewhere else, northwardly." Rumor had Jefferson nearing madness. "I ever thought him to rank domestic happiness in the first class of the chief good," Edmund Randolph told James Madison, "but scarcely supposed that his grief would be so violent as to justify the circulating report of his swooning away whenever he sees his children." His epitaph for Patty came from Homer, from the heart of the Iliad. He had the words inscribed in Greek. Only the educated would be able to share in his memorial to his wife. Alexander Pope had translated the lines Jefferson selected this way. "If, in the melancholy shades below, the flames of friends and lovers cease to glow, yet mine shall sacred last. Mine, undecayed, burn on through death and animate my shade." In his mind, the connection with Patty was eternal, able even to overcome the customs of Hades. For now, though, a phrase on the tombstone captured the unavoidable truth. Martha Jefferson, intermarried with Thomas Jefferson, January 1, 1772, torn from him by death, September 6, 1782. A month later, he was alluding to the possibility of suicide. "This miserable kind of existence is really too burdensome to be borne," he wrote. "And were it not for the infidelity of deserting the sacred charge left me, I could not wish its continuance a moment. His world seemed to have died with Patty. All my plans of comfort and happiness reversed by a single event, and nothing answering in prospect before me but a gloom unbrightened with one cheerful expectation, he wrote his sister-in-law, Elizabeth Epps. He would endure for Patsy, Polly, and Lucy. He knew his duty to his children and to his neighbors. I will endeavor to keep what I feel to myself, that I may not dispirit you from a communication with us, he told Mrs. Epps. I say nothing of coming to Eppington because I promised you this should not be till I could support such a countenance as might not cast a damp on the cheerfulness of others. He was a long way from that point. His wanderings in the woods and his rides with Patsy were all he could manage. Part 4. The Frustrated Congressman. Late 1782 to mid-1784. I know no danger so dreadful and so probable as that of internal contests, and I know no remedy so likely to prevent it as the strengthening of the band which connects us. Thomas Jefferson, On America Under the Articles of Confederation. Chapter 15. Return to the Arena. The states will go to war with each other in defiance of Congress. One will call in France to her assistance, another Great Britain, and so we shall have all the wars of Europe brought to our own doors. Thomas Jefferson on his fears about a weak national government. He was nearly 40 years old, and until recently he had never really failed at anything. A favored son, a brilliant student, a legislator of his state at age 25, author of the Summary View at 31, and of the Declaration of Independence at 33, governor of Virginia at 36. Thomas Jefferson was accustomed to public success and popular praise, to moving from strength to strength and from glory to glory. No more. His beloved wife had died. His administration of Virginia in the face of the attacks of Benedict Arnold and Charles Cornwallis was widely seen as little less than disastrous. The details did not much matter. The fact was that people thought Jefferson's leadership had been found wanting. It was a fact Jefferson hated, but it was a fact nonetheless. Like the poet Dante, who found himself wandering in a dark wood at about the same age, Jefferson was forced to make his peace with the bitterness of his recent experience. He had to come to terms with the reality that he was no longer an immaculately golden public figure. Unless he convinced himself that no great life was without its mishaps and its mistakes, he would not be able to return to the arena. Musing on the perils of fame as he prepared to put himself before the world again, he wrote George Rogers Clark, who had won celebrated victories during the war and faced criticism. That you have enemies you must not doubt, when you reflect that you have made yourself eminent. It is impossible to read these lines without thinking of how they applied to their author, as they did to his correspondent. If you meant to escape malice, you should have confined yourself within the sleepy line of regular duty, Jefferson wrote Clark. When you transgressed this and enterprised deeds which will hand down your name with honor to future times, you made yourself a mark for malice and envy to shoot at. Of these there is enough both in and out of office. Anguish was the price a public man paid for adulation. Since his governorship, Jefferson understood that in a way he never had before. He also knew that pressing ahead was the only way to leave the past behind. There was no other way to do it, unless one chose to retire forever, which could make things worse, for then there was no opportunity to leave marks large enough to overshadow the marks of failure. Given that adversity itself was an intrinsic element of the political life Jefferson had chosen, the test of such a life came when one had to choose which path to take in adversity's wake. The personal and political miseries of 1781 and 1782, the invasions by the British, the aspersions on his character, and the death of his wife, might well have sent lesser men back to their plantations in bitterness and in anger at the injustice of it all. Not Jefferson. He chose advance over retreat. When news of Patty Jefferson's death reached Philadelphia, Jefferson's allies in the Congress asked him to serve on the Paris Peace Commission in France, tasked with crafting the post-war order. Jefferson accepted with alacrity. "I had 2 months before that lost the cherished companion of my life, in whose affections, unabated on both sides, I had lived the last 10 years in uncheckered happiness," Jefferson recalled. With the public interests, the state of my mind concurred in recommending the change of scene proposed. Tuesday, November 26, 1782, proved something of a turning point in Jefferson's life. Visiting Ampthill, the plantation on the James River near Falling Creek that belonged to Archibald Carey, a revolutionary colleague, Jefferson was overseeing family inoculations for smallpox when he fully re-engaged with his correspondence, and with the world beyond the one delineated by his grief of the previous 3 months. In a draft message accepting his appointment as an envoy to France, Jefferson said that he intended to pursue the object of my mission with integrity and impartial regard to the good of the whole states. His emphasis on his broader vision and global portfolio served, he may have hoped, to turn the page on the last unhappy chapter in his political career. He was, in any event, eager to get started. "I shall lose no moment," Jefferson said, "in preparing for my departure." In a letter to the Marquis de Chateauneuf, he returned to the grim events of that autumn. He had not replied to earlier correspondence, Jefferson said, for he was only now a little emerging from that stupor of mind which had rendered me as dead to the world as she was, whose loss occasioned it. He left his two younger children, Polly and Lucy, with Francis and Elizabeth Epps, married relatives of his late wife. The eldest, Patsy, was to travel with her father to his new assignment in Paris. From Monticello on Sunday, December 15, 1782, Jefferson published a notice in the Virginia Gazette announcing that he had confided the care of his affairs to his brother-in-law, Francis Epps of Chesterfield, and to his friend Nicholas Lewis of Albemarle County. Jefferson and Patsy left home 4 days later. He did not know when they would return. Jefferson was eager to get away, the farther the better. But neither the British nor the weather was cooperating. He and Patsy expected to sail from Baltimore with the French minister on the frigate Romulus. The ship was frozen in a few miles below Baltimore, so Jefferson remained in Philadelphia, reacquainting himself with the national political scene he had left 6 years before. He and his daughter took rooms at Mary House's establishment at Fifth and Market. Mrs. House's boarding house offered charming political company, including Madison, and provided the grieving Jefferson with what he had always needed, and since his friendship with his sister Jane had always had, a connection with a sympathetic woman, in this case, Eliza House Trist, the daughter of his landlady. Eliza Trist came to play a sustaining role in Jefferson's life as a long-time admiring friend. At Mrs. House's lodgings, Jefferson played a supporting role in the domestic drama of the 32-year-old Madison's wooing of 15-year-old Catherine Kitty Floyd. The beautiful daughter of the New York Congressman William Floyd, Kitty won the solemn Madison's heart. Jefferson joined what he called the household's raillery as it charted the romance. In addition to spending time among colleagues, old and new, Jefferson took detailed notes on a secret journal of foreign affairs kept by Charles Thompson, the Secretary of the Continental Congress. Jefferson studied the diplomatic correspondence between the Congress and Benjamin Franklin in France, John Jay in Spain, and John Adams in Holland. He reviewed instructions to commissioners to foreign states and the appointments of envoys to Vienna, Russia, Prussia, and Tuscany. He read Madison's paper, Observations Relating to the Influence of Vermont and the Territorial Claims on the Politics of Congress, and considered documents related to Spanish-American disputes over the lands east of the Mississippi. Attuned to how others saw the world, and understanding that most of them saw it with themselves at the center, Jefferson reached out to his future colleague John Jay, then an American diplomat in Europe. "Had I joined you at a more early period, I am sure I should not have added to the strength of the commission, and coming in at the 11th hour, I can propose no more than to avoid doing mischief." It was a disarming note, designed to allay any jealousies or annoyances at the late arrival of a new diplomat. Jefferson was taking care to cultivate those around him. And those above him, too. He wrote George Washington an ingratiating letter. Washington's preeminence in the life of the nation was clear. In war, Jefferson had maintained the most cordial of relations with him. At the possible approach of peace, he wanted to make himself pleasant to Washington, and perhaps useful. He offered Washington, "My individual tribute to your excellency for all you have suffered and all you have effected for us." Then came news that concluded Jefferson's mission before it had begun. Jay and the incumbent American representatives in France had completed a draft of the Treaty of Paris with Great Britain, the document officially ending the Revolutionary War. The text of the pact was en route to the United States, where the Congress would have to ratify it. Jefferson returned to Virginia, a reluctant private citizen once more, yet made his ambitions clear to James Madison. He wanted to be in the action again. "Should the call be made on me, which was sometimes the subject of our conversation," Jefferson wrote, "he would enthusiastically return to the national stage." It did not take long. On Friday, June 6, 1783, Jefferson was elected to the Congress. Edmund Randolph's report of the news to Madison was succinct. Mr. Jefferson was placed at the head of the delegation, not without his approbation. Jefferson had been without a public position for less than a month. The Congress to which Jefferson was elected was the only institution of national government. Created by the Articles of Confederation, it was an inherently weak body. There was neither a separate executive nor a judicial branch, only the Congress. A state could not be represented without two members. A majority of 9 of the 13 states had to agree on most large questions, limiting the government's effectiveness. Even if there were a quorum present and in agreement about major issues, the Congress had little power. It could not tax, regulate national trade, or create a military, though it was authorized to declare war. There was no means of enforcement. The states were essentially sovereign nations, which left the national government ill-equipped to create coherent foreign and commercial policies that might strengthen the young country. The year 1783 had much in common with 1774. It was a time of twilight, an hour when the answers to great questions were unclear. In 1774, the issue was war. In 1783, it was peace, or more precisely, whether Americans could emerge from the conflict and govern themselves as a sovereign power. Beginning with Benjamin Franklin's 1775 proposal for an Articles of Confederation, Jefferson had been thinking about the practicalities of governing at the national level. He served on the committee to consider Franklin's paper, and was appointed to another panel in 1783 to devise a visible head of the government during vacations of Congress. The result was a committee of the states, and Jefferson was a persistent advocate of more, rather than less, central control. The committee failed. This was then imputed to the temper of 2 or 3 individuals, Jefferson recalled, but the wise ascribed it to the nature of man. Later in his career, Jefferson was able to draw on the experience of wartime Virginia and the collapse of the mid-1780s national structure to become a disciple of a unitary, but accountable, executive. History offered no contrary examples. "Our plan best, I believe, combines wisdom and practicability by providing a plurality of counselors, but a single arbiter for ultimate decision," he said of the American presidency. Contemplating the situation in the Confederation Congress of 1783, Jefferson worried about nothing less than anarchy. Now that the Revolutionary War was won, what was to keep state from turning on state or region on region? A power of central, national, and binding force was the only answer. The task was clear. Jefferson and his contemporaries had to lay their shoulders to the strengthening of the band of our Confederacy and averting those cruel evils to which its present weakness will expose us. The problems would persist for much of the 1780s. "I have long thought and become daily more convinced that the construction of our federal government is fundamentally wrong," John Jay wrote to Jefferson in 1786. "To vest legislative, judicial, and executive powers in one and the same body of men, and that, too, in a body daily changing its members, can never be wise. The same year, Jefferson told James Monroe, "There never will be money in the treasury till the Confederacy shows its teeth. The states must see the rod. Perhaps it must be felt by some one of them." Without a powerful union, he expected the worst. The question was not only of political science or of law, but of character. The prospects for the survival of the new nation lay with the people themselves. In 1782, the issue had been framed pithily and well. "What then is the American, this new man?" asked J. Hector St. John de Crèvecœur in his Letters from an American Farmer. Jefferson had been trying to answer that query for several years, albeit with a provincial, not a national, focus. In 1780, the Marquis de Barbé-Marbois, secretary of the French legation in America, had sent Jefferson a series of questions about Virginia. The result was Jefferson's most sustained literary effort, a book, not published until a few years later in Paris, entitled Notes on the State of Virginia. Organized as answers to the specific questions posed by Marbois, from an exact description of the limits and boundaries of the state of Virginia to the particular customs and manners that may happen to be received in that state, the work is precise but eclectic, formal yet conversational. His pride in his native land is evident. The text is full of rhapsodic descriptions of the natural beauties of Virginia. He was also realistic about the difficulties of governing in a time of revolution. The government of his state was an unusual combination of elements. It is a composition of the freest principles of the English Constitution, with others derived from natural right and natural reason. To these, nothing can be more opposed than the maxims of absolute monarchies. What was true in Virginia, Jefferson was to find, was also true in America more broadly. The search for the point of temperate power between competing elements of life, the national government and the states and the people, was far from over. In an evening's conversation on a rainy journey home to Orange, James Madison sounded fellow Virginian George Mason out on the questions of the day, discovering only one real example of heterodoxy. Mason, Madison told Jefferson, was too little impressed with either the necessity or the proper means of preserving the Confederacy. In two largely neglected pieces, published anonymously in the Pennsylvania Journal or Weekly Advertiser in this period, Madison made an impassioned case for a strong national government, a case that, as Mason's views indicated, was failing to resonate broadly. Madison was having problems of a personal nature, too. Kitty Floyd broke off their engagement, crushing him. Concerned about his friend, Jefferson rapidly replied with warmth and empathy, "I sincerely lament the misadventure which has happened, from whatever cause it may have happened. No event has been more contrary to my expectations, and these were founded on what I thought a good knowledge of the ground. But of all machines, ours is the most complicated and inexplicable." Jefferson's words of consolation came from a good friend, one who knew sadness and who tried to take, as of old, a philosophical view of life's disappointments. He had experienced heartbreak and desolation, and he had, painfully and arduously, kept his own emotional machinery working well enough to propel him forward despite all. He believed Madison would, too. Jefferson, meanwhile, could never know too much. 10 days after his election to the National Congress, he asked a delegate to the Virginia General Assembly at Richmond to keep him minutely informed about state politics. "Parliamentary news is interesting, and I hear little or nothing of it," he wrote the delegate on Tuesday, June 17, 1783. "What have you done? What are you doing? What are the maneuvers of your leaders? Who are they? What the dispositions of the two houses, etc.?" Information, as ever, was power. Chapter 16. A Struggle for Respect. Foreign Civil Arrangement and Foreign Treaties. Domestic Civil Arrangement. Domestic Peace Establishment of Arsenals and Posts. Western Territory. Indian Affairs. Money. Thomas Jefferson, listing the issues facing post-war America. The Congress was homeless as well as largely powerless. Seated in Philadelphia, slated to move to Annapolis later in 1783, the lawmakers were driven out of Pennsylvania in the third week of June when 300 Continental soldiers mutinied, storming the Congress to demand pay. Pennsylvania officials who had jurisdiction over the city refused to intercede, prompting the Congress to evacuate Philadelphia for Princeton in New Jersey. The national government, in other words, was on the run from its own people. Appearances mattered much at this delicate hour. James Madison reported a strong inclination among the national lawmakers to leave Princeton and return to Philadelphia, even at the risk of physical danger, in order to prevent any inferences abroad of disaffection in the mass of so important a state to the Revolution or the federal government. The Congress nevertheless remained at Princeton until it moved to Annapolis in November 1783. Though uncertain where the Congress would be sitting by the time his term began in the autumn, Jefferson had asked Madison to secure him a room of any size with Mrs. House if in Philadelphia, and he sought Mrs. Trist's counsel on schooling for Patsy, who was to stay in that city no matter where the legislature held its sessions. Jefferson left Monticello on Thursday, October 16, 1783. Traveling through Philadelphia, he arrived in Princeton to take his seat on November 4th. It was the briefest of stays. On the evening of Jefferson's arrival there, the Congress adjourned to Annapolis. Princeton had offered scanty accommodations. Madison dismissed it as a village where the public business can neither be conveniently done, the members of Congress decently provided for, nor those connected with Congress provided for at all. To achieve order required authority, which the states wanted, but the Congress needed. Neither a reflexive nationalist nor a states' rights purist, categories that were already taking form, Jefferson was grappling with the distribution of power in a country of diverse interests. His view of the role of the Confederation Congress in 1783-84 was in keeping with his thinking in the wake of his governorship. Whoever was in charge needed to be clearly and certainly in command. As the United States in Congress assembled represent the sovereignty of the whole Union, he wrote, their body collectively and their president individually should on all occasions have precedence over all other bodies and persons. Even if he were referring only to ceremonial occasions, the point was clear. To be effective, the Congress had to be granted pride of place. Annapolis was quiet. Too quiet, Jefferson believed, for the seat of the Congress of a victorious nation. It is now above a fortnight since we should have met, and six states only appear, he wrote Madison in December 1783. They needed nine to form a quorum and proceed. We have some hopes of Rhode Island coming in today, but when two more will be added seems as insusceptible of calculation as when the next earthquake will happen. Franklin, Adams, and Jay, the commissioners abroad, wrote that the riot of Philadelphia and departure of Congress thence made the most serious impressions in Europe and have excited great doubts of the stability of our Confederacy and in what we shall end, Jefferson said. The business at hand was momentous. The Congress had only a limited amount of time to ratify the Treaty of Paris, the pact ending the Revolutionary War and granting America recognition as an independent nation. On Saturday, December 13, 1783, Jefferson was appointed to a committee to consider the treaty. There were 10 major provisions, among them a generous grant of territory and a promise by the British to return confiscated property, including slaves. Critical, too, was Article 10 concerning process. The treaty had to be ratified within 6 months of its signing, which had occurred in Paris on Wednesday, September 3, 1783. Though Jefferson's committee moved the ratification of the treaty, there was still no quorum in the Congress. No quorum, no action. Jefferson hated the feeling of powerlessness. It was a troubling Christmas Eve. He was not feeling well, and he was worried. I cannot help expressing my extreme anxiety at our present critical situation, Jefferson wrote a Virginia correspondent on Wednesday, December 24, 1783. There was now only a little over 2 months to ratify the treaty and return it to Paris. All that can be said is that it is yet possible, Jefferson wrote, hoping for action before Britain attempted to force new changes, should the ratification not come in time. On New Year's Day, 1784, Jefferson was gloomy and sick. "I have had very ill health since I have been here, and am getting rather lower than otherwise," he told Madison. If the Congress did not act quickly, the United States would humiliate itself abroad by failing to ratify and deliver the treaty in time. If it acted without the 9 states, though, the national government risked the appearance of usurpation. Jefferson sought a compromise, some means of preserving, establishing, actually, the nation's international reputation without exposing the Congress to charges of overreaching. With lawyerly precision, Jefferson drafted a motion that took advantage of an earlier vote and extended its authority to the finished treaty. The means of saving the day were secured. In the end, Connecticut and New Jersey at length arrived, and the treaty was ratified by 9 states. For the moment, the system had succeeded in ratifying the treaty that, in turn, ratified the Revolution. Jefferson drafted a proclamation to announce the news. In it, he called on all the good citizens of these states to draw on that good faith which is every man's surest guide to respect and to fulfill the articles of peace entered into, on their behalf, under the authority of that federal bond by which their existence as an independent people is bound up together and is known and acknowledged by the nations of the world. There was much work to be done. Jefferson thought that were it certain we could be brought to act as one united nation on trade policy, then Britain would make extensive concessions. As it was, however, she is not afraid of retaliation. Still, the resolution of months of tension and uncertainty lifted Jefferson's spirits and may have improved his health. "I have been just able to attend my duty in the State House, but not to go out on any other occasion," he told Patsy. The day after ratification, however, he said he was considerably better. The author of the Declaration of Independence had declared the peace, affirming anew the national, not sectional, identity of the country. With its attention to the occupation of forts, the treaty raised issues about the future of the American West, a long-time interest of Jefferson's. His was an obsession, romantic, scientific, and practical. He loved the image of endless forests. In this vision, he was like a Saxon of old, dwelling in primordial liberty. And he was fascinated by what he called the different species of bones, teeth, and tusks of the mammoth, and other natural specimens. The French naturalist, the Comte de Buffon, who argued that animal and plant life in the New World was inferior, was always on Jefferson's mind. In Philadelphia in 1784, Jefferson would buy an uncommonly large panther skin to show Buffon. He was also a patriot and a politician, and he worried, as he had during the years of the war, about the threat of a frontier beyond American control. "I find they have subscribed a very large sum of money in England for exploring the country from the Mississippi to California," Jefferson wrote George Rogers Clark from Annapolis in December 1783. "They pretend it is only to promote knowledge. I'm afraid they have thoughts of colonizing into that quarter. Some of us have been talking here in a feeble way of making the attempt to search that country." He fretted, though, about finding the means to do it. "But I doubt whether we have enough of that kind of spirit to raise the money. How would you like to lead such a party?" The man who saw America's story in terms of the march of human events was aware of the scale of the experiment in which he was participating. In the first week of December 1783, Jefferson made inquiries about purchasing a mechanical copying device through Samuel House, a brother of Eliza House Trist and a Philadelphia merchant. He wanted to ensure that his role was part of the saga of the age, when the time came for the telling of tales and the weaving of history. Jefferson had been thinking in such terms since he began sending out his original version of the Declaration of Independence. Now he was taking steps to preserve the daily, even hourly record of a life lived on the largest possible stage. Chapter 17. Lost Cities and Life Council. The governor is a most ingenuous naturalist and philosopher, a truly scientific and learned man, and every way excellent. Ezra Stiles, the president of Yale College on Jefferson. In Philadelphia, all the talk was of balloons. Congress imagined that when they removed to Annapolis to pout, we should all be in deep distress, and for every pout return a sigh. But the event is far otherwise. Jefferson's friend, Francis Hopkinson, wrote him in March 1784. The name of Congress is almost forgotten, and for one person that will mention that respectable body, 100 will talk of an air balloon. It was a season of grand ballooning experiments in Paris. Word of the flights, including a manned one in November 1783, spread rapidly. Jefferson sensed the revolutionary possibilities of human control of the air. "What think you of these balloons? They really begin to assume a serious face," he wrote. Reports had people flying 6 miles in 20 minutes at 3,000 feet. He took a jocular tone, but his words were prescient. "This discovery seems to threaten the prostration of fortified works unless they can be closed above, the destruction of fleets and what not. The French may now run over their laces, wines, etc. to England, duty-free. The whole system of British statutes, made on the supposition of goods being brought into some port, must be revised. Inland countries may now become maritime states, unless you choose rather to call them aerial ones, as their commerce is in the future to be carried on through that element. But, jesting apart, I think this discovery may lead to things useful." 10 years later in Philadelphia, Jefferson saw the first successful manned balloon flight in America. His friend Hopkinson, a lawyer, writer, and signer of the Declaration of Independence, saw a witty connection between the political and the scientific. "A high-flying politician," Hopkinson wrote, "is, I think, not unlike a balloon. He is full of inflammability. He is driven along by every current of wind. And those who will suffer themselves to be carried up by them run a great risk that the bubble may burst and let them fall from the height to which a principle of levity had raised them." Jefferson's scientific curiosity never abated. One day, James Madison wrote with extraordinary news from abroad. He had been told a subterraneous city had been discovered in Siberia, which appears to have been once populous and magnificent. Among other curiosities, it contains an equestrian statue around the neck of which was a gold